This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Red Cross warns that Israel's invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah will pose a disastrous risk to civilian lives and infrastructure. Pro-Palestine activists stage protest actions outside two UK-based firms over their role in fueling the Israeli regime's genocide in the Gaza Strip. And Spain and Ireland demand the European Union to conduct an urgent probe into Israel's compliance with its human rights commitments during the onslaught on Gaza. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. The Israeli regime, it continues pounding the besieged Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery fire more than 130 days into its campaign of genocide. At least five Palestinians were killed after Israeli warplanes targeted residential buildings in Al Zaytun area. In the north of Gaza City, two women and a child were killed by an Israeli airstrike on a vehicle. Earlier on Wednesday, eight Palestinians were killed and nearly two dozen others injured in Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital and the Nusayra refugee camp in central Gaza. The Gaza Health Ministry says over 103 Palestinians have been killed in the last day, pushing the overall death toll to almost 28,600. The looming Israeli invasion of Gaza's southern city of Rafah has triggered global alarms over potential civilian casualties. The International Committee of the Red Cross says the regime's military aggression will pose a disastrous risk to civilian lives and infrastructure. The Red Cross's Middle East director has called on Israel to take necessary measures to protect civilians. Fabrizio Carboni demanded the fundamental principles of humanity be upheld in any military operation. They also cautioned against forced displacement of Palestinians and the regime's indiscriminate attacks on civilian areas, stressing they're all banned under international humanitarian law. Meanwhile, Germany's foreign minister has also expressed concern over the planned incursion into Rafah, saying it will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe.
More than half of Gaza's population is currently seeking shelter in Rafah. 1.3 million people are waiting there in a very small space. They don't really have anywhere else to go right now. Many of them have followed Israeli evacuation orders and fled the fighting areas in northern Gaza, often with nothing more than their small children in their arms and the last of their clothes on. These people cannot simply vanish into thin air. If the Israeli army were to launch an offensive on Rafah under these conditions, it would be a humanitarian catastrophe in the making.
Annalena Baerbock emphasized the need of providing safe places and secure corridors to prevent mass civilian casualties. She also called for more border crossings to be opened for the delivery of humanitarian aid and medical supplies to the people of Gaza. Baerbock stressed a ceasefire is urgently needed in the besieged territory.
Rafah was once a safe haven for Palestinians fleeing northern Gaza Strip in the earliest stages of the Israeli onslaught. That's when the regime forced the Palestinians to evacuate their homes ahead of heavy bombardments. This is the status quo in Rafah now. The whole city has turned into a large, overcrowded refugee camp. Aerial images show how the population in Rafah more than quadrupled in a matter of a few months. Most residents are living in temporary structures such as tents, and aid organizations have warned of a dire humanitarian situation. Food and water are scarce, and the city's overburdened health infrastructure is on the brink. Life in Rafah has grown unbearable for people who have been traumatized by the loss of their loved ones, destruction of their homes, repeated displacements, and the uncertainty of their life in what has become the world's largest refugee camp. But could it get any worse?
This area was supposed to be a safe zone, but there is no safety across the entire Gaza Strip.
They said Rafah is safe, so we came here. What else could have brought us here? And now they are bombarding Rafah. Where could we possibly go?
Just in one instance, around 100 Palestinians were killed in Israeli airstrikes in Rafah on February 12th. The city is located in the southernmost part of the Gaza Strip. It's trapped between Egypt in the south, the Mediterranean Sea in the west, Israeli-occupied territories in the east, and Israeli troops in the north. Egypt has blocked the border crossing as it doesn't want refugees from Gaza. All this amid Israel's push for a ground invasion into Rafah under the pretext of arresting Hamas leaders. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the Israeli army to evacuate civilians from the city. But where should the Palestinians, who are struck between the devil and the deep blue sea, go to?
As calls grow for Israel to hold back its planned assault on Rafah, criticism of Tel Aviv's staunchest ally, the U.S., has been mounting. International human rights organizations have warned that any further escalation in Rafah will have unimaginable ramifications. So far, there has been no signal of an end to the onslaught, and latest round of truce talks underway in Egypt have also proven inconclusive.
The United Nations has warned that an Israeli ground invasion of Rafah, which it says is crammed with almost half of the Gaza population, could lead to slaughter, as millions have taken shelter there. Yet, news headlines indicate that there is no silver lining for Palestinians, especially for those in Rafah. The latest round of truce talks among the United States, Egypt, Israel, and Qatar in Cairo have not borne fruit yet. The looming threat of Israel's ground invasion of Rafah has even sparked criticism from Tel Aviv's European allies. However, the European allies of Israel have not stopped there and even blamed the main supporter of Tel Aviv for the unfolding crisis in Gaza. This is not the first time Washington has been censured for its involvement in the killing of innocent Palestinians. The U.S. is a key military backer of Israel and has repeatedly vetoed Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. On Tuesday, Senate passed another foreign aid package that includes $14.1 billion for Israel's genocidal onslaught on the Gaza Strip. This comment by President Joe Biden during a joint press conference at the White House with Jordan's King Abdullah has sparked new controversies regarding the U.S. complicity in the Gaza onslaught. While this was later described as a slip of tongue, recent protests in front of the White House clearly show if this is an Israeli onslaught or a U.S.-Israeli onslaught in Gaza.
A group of pro-Palestine activists have staged protest actions outside two UK-based firms over their role in fueling the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. First protest targeted the Manchester offices of the Bank of New York Mellon, which were drenched in red paint to symbolize the bank's complicity in genocide of Palestinians by Israel. A second protest saw activists blockading a Bristol headquarters of the Elbit Systems, which is Israel's largest weapons firm. They attached themselves to one another to prevent access into the central hub of what activists described as Elbit's lethal business. Activists condemned the Bank of New York Mellon for investing over £10 million in Elbit systems. Now, Elbit provides 85% of Israel's military drone fleet, land-based military equipment, missiles, bullets, and other weaponry. Events marked the latest in a series of pro-Palestine rallies held to force Israel's Western allies to stop supplying the regime with weapons amid its genocidal campaign. Spain and Ireland, meanwhile, have demanded the European Union launch an urgent probe into Israel's actions in Gaza. They said the EU must ascertain if the regime is complying with its human rights obligations under an accord with the bloc. Now, the request came in a letter to the EU Commission by Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez and his Irish counterpart Leo Varadkar. They asked the EU to take appropriate measures if Israel is found to be violating its agreement with the bloc. The court demands Israel respect the principles of human rights and democracy as an essential element of the bloc's trade ties with the regime. The unprecedented move raises the possibility of EU imposing economic sanctions against Tel Aviv. Spain's foreign minister, José Manuel Álvarez, also said no license to export weapons to Israel has been approved by his country since October the 7th, and none will be as long as the onslaught on Gaza continues. And meanwhile, truce talks in Cairo have yet to achieve any breakthroughs as calls continue for Israel to avoid a full-fledged attack on the southern Gaza city of Rafah. We discussed this with our guests earlier in our news review program. Here it is.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. In the Egyptian capital, Cairo, negotiations are underway to bring more than 4 months of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza to a halt. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it has sent a delegation to Cairo to meet with Egyptian and Qatari mediators. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has also arrived in Cairo for talks with President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. The heads of Israel's spy agencies, Mossad and Shin Bet, sat down with U.S., Egyptian, and Qatari representatives on Tuesday to secure a ceasefire deal. No significant breakthrough has been achieved in negotiations that are set to take another 3 days. Israeli media has revealed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is opposed to a proposal put forward by spy chiefs on a deal. Hamas has accused Netanyahu of trying to buy time to pursue his own agenda while proposing a ceasefire. Hamas wants a full halt to Israeli strikes, troop withdrawal, and prisoner swap, among other conditions. Jim Cavanaugh is a political analyst and blogger joining us from New York. We also have Sandal Salasad, who's a journalist and commentator, joining us from Beirut. Sandal Assad, there was this first proposal just a couple weeks back, I believe, a three-stage one, of which Hamas had given an initial green light, so to speak. But there were some terms that it revised and was sent to Israel, of which the Prime Minister Netanyahu rejected. Now, we don't know about what has happened in the past 48 hours in terms of what was on the table, but there must have been some kind of reason for this to want to be continued. What do you think about the whole thing anyways, when you have such divergent views? For example, Hamas has said, we want all the regime forces out of the Gaza Strip. That's just one of them.
Okay. First of all, we have always to mention that the aggression is led currently against the people of Gaza is led and launched by the U.S. And the decision of the war and stopping the war or continuing the war is the decision of the American administration. So as we are reaching the point of the presidential elections in the United States, especially Biden, is trying to pressure Netanyahu and the Zionist regime into stopping this genocide in order, because we know that this is an attempt to burnish the bloody image of the U.S. after they have committed, they have killed more than roughly 28,000 Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. And after the clear failure of the Zionist apartheid regime to achieve any of its aims or goals of this aggression, they have failed to free any of theirs. They have failed to free their prisoners from the Palestinian resistance, and they have failed to weaken the Palestinian resistance. We have seen how the people of Gaza stand side by side with their resistance, and have rejected the American and the Zionist decision to replace them and to expel them to Sinai.
You know, we're looking at these talks. I'm going to call it round two, because round one, Netanyahu came and flat out rejected it. He's still rejecting it, but we're not sure what he's rejecting this time around exactly, because when there are such differences in the core issues, and we can name a number of them, it's still a wonder why it is that they're even having these talks in the first place. What's your view on this?
What you have, I think, is kabuki theater. I think this is being done for the benefit of the Arab states, for the benefit of the American public and the European public. And you know, they have to pretend there something is possible here that sidesteps all, as you say, all the fundamental issues that are there. But Israel is saying very clearly, we're going for complete victory in Gaza. They're not going to get complete victory. Look, everybody knows, and everybody should know, and not be fooled, this is not about the struggle between, the fight between Hamas and Israel, whether Israel's after battalions of Hamas fighters in Rafah. They are after killing and expelling as many Palestinians as they want. Okay. The fight with Hamas and Hezbollah, that's all going on, that's important, but it doesn't determine whether or not the Palestinians, where the Palestinians are going to be in Gaza, are going to be in 6 months or 3 months or a year. And Israel wants to invade Gaza in order to force the Palestinians to flee, to force Egypt to open its border, to force other countries to take them. They're sitting there saying, watch us, we're killing everybody in Gaza until you let them go, until you take them away. We're not going to stop. So, you know, and Hamas is saying, we want Israel to get out of Gaza, to Israeli army not to control Gaza anymore. And Israel is saying, that's not going to happen. We are going to continue as we have veto power over everything that happens in Gaza. And the Americans are completely behind Israel, and this will not stop until some military force challenges Israel, says, Egypt can open its borders, say, we're bringing humanitarian aid in, and we're not allowing you to stop us. Want to have an armed conflict? We'll have an armed conflict. Somebody else can do that. But until that happens, Israel is going to continue killing Gazans until they try to create a situation where the world is forced to take them out.
The Hezbollah resistance movement has strongly condemned Israel's latest strikes on civilians in southern Lebanon, saying they will not go unanswered. Head of Hezbollah's executive council, Hashem Safi al-Din, vowed the movement will undoubtedly respond to the regime's incursions at an appropriate level. He added, Israel will never achieve the goals that it failed to attain during previous acts of aggression against Lebanon. His comments came after, on Wednesday, Israeli warplanes struck several villages in southern Lebanon, killing four civilians, including a mother and her two children. A later strike on the city of Nabatea killed four civilians from the same family, including two women. The regime claims its attack was in response to an earlier Hezbollah strike that targeted several Israeli military sites, killing one soldier and injuring eight others. Hezbollah says the strikes on Israeli sites will continue until the regime stops its campaign of genocide in Gaza. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
All evidence suggests that the United States was a direct partner in the Zionist regime's genocidal war against Gaza, and it has done its utmost to prevent any form of solidarity, be it military, humanitarian, or legal, to save the Palestinians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, more than 100 days after an Israeli regime onslaught, which turned genocidal, on the besieged Gaza Strip, the American administration is finally admitting to committing mistakes or missteps in how it responded to the genocide. It is unclear whether the administration is genuine in its admission or if it is directly linked to the upcoming presidential elections in which Arab American constituencies are set to play a vital role in highly contested states. It might be the latter, as the U.S. admission, according to the New York Times, happened in a closed-door meeting with Arab American leaders in Michigan. In the meeting, one of President Biden's top foreign policy aides acknowledged mistakes in the administration's response to the war in Gaza, saying he did not have any confidence that Israel's government was willing to take meaningful steps toward Palestinian statehood. While it is true that the U.S. administration has, at times, urged the child killer regime of Israel to conduct so-called surgical operations in its war against the Palestinian resistance, top U.S. officials, including Biden himself, has fanned the flames of war since the very beginning. Biden has gone as far as claiming that the Zionist regime's war is linked to the safety of the Jewish people and that who dare know Israel, there wouldn't be a Jew in the world who is safe. His Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, visited the occupied Palestinian territories called Israel immediately after the October 7th operation, and many times since then, declaring that he was there not only as Secretary of State, but also as a Jew. These statements were backed by two tangible policies, which continue until this day. On the one hand, the U.S. still refuses to call for an immediate ceasefire, and on the other, the United States continues to support the Israeli regime military with thousands of tons of munitions and other killing technologies. Moreover, the U.S. Senate is currently voting on an additional aid package, which would grant the Zionist regime $14 billion. This is in addition to the $3.8 billion of annual aid, which also mostly goes to the Israeli regime army. The comments in the meeting were conveyed by a Biden side, John Feiner, who is also the Deputy National Security Advisor. He said, as quoted in New York Times, "We were very well aware that we have missteps in the course of responding to this crisis since October 7th. He added, "We have left a very damaging impression based on what has been a wholly inadequate public accounting for how much the president, the administration, and the country values the lives of Palestinians. And that began, frankly, pretty early in the conflict." The revelations come a day following comments by Biden where he stated that the Zionist regime has gone over the top in response to the Hamas operation. For weeks, mostly U.S. media has been reporting on serious disagreements between the Biden administration and the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu. The White House has reportedly criticized Netanyahu for failing to provide a post-war vision, acknowledged the centrality of the two-state solution, and for wanting to ethnically cleanse Palestinians into the Egyptian Sinai Desert. Ramzi Baruch, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, said, "This might, to some extent, be true. The Biden administration, however, failed to connect any of its demands and expectations to its ongoing financing of the genocide." Baruch added that it would be unfair to say that the United States has supported Israel in its war against the Palestinian people. all evidence suggests that the United States was a direct partner in the war, and it has done its utmost to prevent any form of solidarity, be it military, humanitarian, or legal, to save the Palestinians from this ongoing Holocaust. Baruch said, if Biden and his aides are frustrated, it is because Netanyahu has miserably failed in translating U.S.-funded Israel's military superiority into actual tangible or strategic gains on the ground. They are angry because he failed in finishing the job, and that failure could potentially cost Biden the presidency.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Our heartiest congratulations to all. Today is the 4th of Shaban. The auspicious birth anniversary of the immortal standard bearer of Kabbalah, Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace be upon him. Here is what his father, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, said entrusting the newborn to the care of the immortal martyr of Karbala. O Hussein, I'm entrusting to you this child. He will represent me on the day of your supreme sacrifice and lay down his life in defending you and your dear ones, much as I would have done if alive on that day.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, the significance of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z Show, the Islamic Revolution of Iran and who the founder of Islamic Revolution was. Who was Imam Khomeini? What were the distinguishing features of his thought process? What provoked people to go against the ruling government of that time, which was the Shah of Iran from the Pahlavi dynasty? Imam Khomeini had certain principles that appealed people, that attracted people, and we're trying to understand those principles so we can understand what the Islamic Revolution was all about. Brothers and sisters, in today's world, unfortunately, we see that in order to make our demands acceptable, we sometimes negotiate with the Satan himself. This negotiation with the Satan is condemned in Islam, but a lot of times, many people fall for it. Imam Khomeini, however, taught something radically different. He did the impossible several times in his life. And he did so without compromising with the enemy. A person with such immense popularity could have gotten whatever he wanted of this world. But Imam Khomeini chose to remain a simple man, even after becoming the supreme leader of an oil-rich, strategically located nation. This is something unique about Ruhullah Musavi Khomeini, and the Islamic Revolution that took place in Iran back in 1979. And now it has grown into a very stable system after 40 years of this revolution. If we compare other revolutions and other revolutionaries with this particular revolution that we are discussing, that is the Islamic Revolution, we would notice a fundamental difference. Welcome back, dear listeners. In other revolutions, the people, their organizations, or even their plans became idols, and so-called revolutionaries dragged the people towards those idols. The Islamic Revolution, however, was undertaken in the name of Allah and for His sake. Imam Khomeini not once sought to create a cult of own personality, but rather always directed people to the righteousness and towards the teachings of Prophet and monotheism. Imam Khomeini raised issues pertaining to the oppressed that had been long forgotten by the world, such as the issue of Palestine. As we all know, brothers and sisters, if we look at today, the public opinion that is predominantly in the favor of the oppressed Palestinians, and if we trace back where did it all start, you will see that it was Imam Khomeini who made this a global issue for the entire Muslim Ummah, rather, not just the Muslim Ummah, rather for every person of conscience. This is what Imam Khomeini did. Imam Khomeini made it a symbol of oppressed people standing up against the oppressors. In this case, Palestinians standing up against the Zionist regime, the illegitimately born Zionist regime of Israel. Imam Khomeini identified the enemies and transgressors without thinking twice about his own life or the potential consequences. He saw it as his obligation to make people aware of the oppressors and to remove the veil from the face of hypocrites. Brothers and sisters, for us, this path of Imam Khomeini, which is also referred to as in Farsi as Khat-e-Imam, this path of Imam Khomeini is that guiding light for every human being, not just for Muslims, not just for Shias, for every single human being out there. This very thought of standing up for the oppressed and standing against and challenging every oppressor is what is required of us as a human being.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor the Israeli political confusion caused by the Palestinian resistance's response to the truce and the captives exchange deal, and also Netanyahu's stubbornness in admitting the failure to achieve the goals of their aggression on the Gaza Strip. This is whilst the Zionist experts and commentators estimate that the resistance still possesses the necessary military capabilities in Gaza. Regarding these issues, I welcome Mr. Fatih Kolib, an analyst on Israeli affairs. Welcome, dear professor. The resistance's response to the Paris proposal regarding the truce and the captives exchange deal does not allow the Zionists to say no in light of the continuing American pressure. In the same context, Zionist commentators believe that the resistance is not in a rush to finalize the captives' exchange deal because it does not feel a real military pressure on it. Professor Fatih Kolib, why have the Zionists not given any official response to the resistance's proposal so far? He mentioned that the War Council meeting has witnessed a sharp division amongst its members during the discussion of these proposals.
First, the main reason is that the divisions within the Zionist regime are expanding more and more. The second point is that the response provided by the resistance factions through the Hamas movement exposed the Israeli positions, which always say that its aggression aims to liberate the captives. Today, the resistance says there is an opportunity to liberate your captives if you adhere to the conditions set by the resistance. The third point is that the Americans have become certain that the Israeli aggression no longer has clear goals for this war, and it is not guaranteed that the Israeli army is capable of making any achievements. More importantly, and this is the main point for the Americans now need to calm down and stop aggression more than the Israelis, because the election campaigns in the United States have entered a serious phase, and it seems clear that Biden and his administration are concerned about internal divisions, not only at the level of the Republican Party, but also at the level of the Democratic Party itself.
Therefore, it's not possible to say no to the resistance proposals in light of this American pressure, and submitting to the resistance now is a loss. Hamas is not in a rush to finalize the captives exchange deal, as long as this Zionist talk that we followed in this report indicates.
Certainly, Hamas has been talking about the issues that it mentioned in its response from day one. Since day one, it said, we are ready for an exchange deal, regardless of the way the occupation wants it. It wanted a comprehensive deal. All in all, there is no problem with Hamas. Hamas also wanted a partial deal. But in the end, the occupation must pay the price for this matter. Based on the lurking nature of the political forces, the occupation is unable to confront it. But it is clear that the Americans are putting as much pressure as possible. It seems clear that Netanyahu wants to go to a deal, but his immediate fear is the duo present within the administration. It seems clear that part of the U.S. Secretary of State's visit is to reassure Netanyahu that if he withdraws Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, there is an alternative, which is the opposition leader Yair Lapid.
Submitting to Hamas has a long-term impact and ramifications for the regime, and it must be eliminated now. Otherwise, we'll turn off the captives into a national Palestinian sport. Netanyahu is still arrogant and claims that he cares about victory over the resistance in Gaza, but the matter requires months, not years. Removing Hamas and the resistance in Gaza is an illusion. And what Netanyahu claims about the occupation's army's ability to achieve this goal is unrealistic. And to the Israeli social media that have frequently focused on Netanyahu's threats and responded with sarcastic comments, and here are some of them.
Levant.
What is victory? They slaughtered us. There will be no victory here.
Rome.
No victory, and Hamas defeated us, and it was over.
Yafa.
A hallucinated man. What victory are you talking about? Hamas has returned to the northern Gaza Strip, which was apparently cleansed, and continues to mislead its voters.
Yoval.
Unfortunately, no other victory is possible after October 7. They have changed the formula to reduce the damage.
Yonatan.
We have already lost this war.
Elinor.
We have not won after all these losses.
Professor Fatih Kolib, how do you explain Netanyahu's arrogance regarding his empty claims about the inevitability of victory over the resistance and these sarcastic comments about him on social media?
They have the right to mock Netanyahu's words since the first day of the aggression. Netanyahu has claimed that he will finish eliminating Hamas and the resistance within a few weeks. The weeks have passed and he has been talking about months. Months have passed and now he is talking about years. The Israelis have become well aware that Netanyahu is lying, or Netanyahu is speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He speaks in front of the media with big words announcing that he doesn't want a ceasefire, and we will continue the military operation to liberate the captives and all of these things. The Israelis know that the reality on the ground is different. Why did he withdraw his brigades from the Gaza Strip if he was really going to continue the military operation? Let's assume that he wants to continue the military operation to liberate the captives. Does he know where the captives are kept? Does he know where the resistance leaders are? Therefore, I say that Netanyahu does not have many options. He has two options. The best of all, either to agree to the deal and become a loser, or to reject the deal and also become a loser.
Therefore, the question is, why is Netanyahu's speech so puffed up with conceit? Is this related to the negotiations, in your opinion?
No, it has nothing to do with any special issue that relates to Netanyahu. Netanyahu knows that when the war stops, the next day there will be talk inside the Zionist community of his resignation, and he will be held accountable for the October 7th attack. Therefore, he knows this issue and is working as much as possible to remain prime minister, because if the war stopped, it would certainly be the fall of the administration, and his going to prison would be inevitable.
Netanyahu's position has been the focus of the Hebrew media. His refusal to stop the aggression and his failure in achieving the goals of removing Hamas and releasing the captives by force. Now Netanyahu is in desperate need of an achievement for his electoral campaign. And we will stay with Netanyahu's positions and the directive of the Israeli army to storm the Rafah area in the south of the Gaza Strip, which the Hebrew media has referred to with great skepticism, considering the difficulty of this matter in the field in the light of the Egyptian position. Mr. Fatih Kolib, what do you think about the reasons for Netanyahu's position in insisting on the continuation of this aggression and directing the army to invade Rafah?
The matter is that he wants to continue the aggression. He has lost control of the war because, according to what is happening in the Gaza Strip, his soldiers are suffering many losses. If he were actually able to continue this aggression as strongly as 4 months ago, the Israeli brigades would have been there now. About going to Rafah, it certainly seems that there is a goal. He says he wants to hunt down the resistance leadership, but it is not clear if he is able to achieve this goal. If we assume that he went to Rafah and was unable to achieve the goal, neither at the level of the resistance group nor at the level of liberating the captives, how would the Zionist community react? There would be another problem. It is now clear to everyone that from the beginning of the aggression until now, every time Netanyahu tries to get out of a predicament, he falls into a new predicament.
What about the Philadelphia Axis in this case?
I believe that this is a statement from the Israeli insider, because it has become clear that the Egyptians are not about to enter into any amendments to the Camp David Accords, because any change at the level of the Philadelphia Axis brings about some of the amendments that the Egyptians had previously proposed to the Americans, and the Americans refused to make any amendments. Therefore, the Americans are not about to make any changes to Netanyahu's agreement to accept the agreement. The Philadelphia Axis, and the Egyptians also, until this moment, still completely reject what Netanyahu is proposing.
The day following the cessation of the aggression against the Gaza Strip is not a bright day for the occupation. The people of Gaza are steadfast and none of them have left, and we must restore ourselves. The widespread disagreements between the occupation leaders and the failure to achieve the goals of this aggression against Gaza reflect themselves within the regime and among the Zionist political forces, and the saying, "We win together," that Netanyahu has started, has fallen into disrepair. Your comment, Professor Fatih Kolib, on these internal disputes?
In my opinion, talking about the future of Gaza was something that was logical in the first days of the aggression. But 4 months have passed, and it's become clear that the occupation is unable to hold on to a small piece of land from the Gaza Strip. It seems that it has become a pipe dream, and it has become impossible for Netanyahu to talk about the future of the Gaza Strip, because whoever wants to talk about about the future of the Gaza Strip and control it, they must own the land as the first step. When we talk about the response of the Palestinian resistance, one of the most important items in their response is that there should not remain any Israeli soldier in the Gaza Strip. This is an issue known to the Americans and known to the Arab official system. It only seems that Netanyahu is the only one talking about the future of the Gaza Strip. However, based on the realities on the ground, he does not have any card in his hand to be able to impose or control the Gaza Strip and its future.
Well, anxiety over the advent of the holy month of Ramadan has begun to interact within Zionist circles as it does every year. But this time, the fears are greater about the escalation of resistance in the West Bank, Jerusalem, or Quds, and the territories occupied in 1948 in light of the aggression against Gaza. Professor Fatih Kolib, what is the explanation for this Zionist concern regarding the blessed month of Ramadan and its impact on the Palestinian resistance against the occupation?
It seems clear that all the intelligence agencies, whether at the Israeli level or at the American and Western levels, are convinced that Israel's practices in the West Bank and the continuation of the aggression against the Gaza Strip during the month of Ramadan would change the equations of the conflict, because during the month of Ramadan, if the occupation continues the genocide in the same manner, this would fuel a Palestinian gathering that would change the nature of the equation, bringing back the Palestinians of 1948. We also know that the Palestinians of 1948 had the advantage in the Battle of Saif al-Quds, when there were widespread explosions at all areas of the regime. Therefore, most international intelligence agencies believe that if the Palestinians of 1948 enter the war, it'll cause a huge problem for the occupation regime. The next stage would be a new, more intense war in the West Bank and in Jerusalem al-Quds.
And to the Yemeni front and its support for Gaza, and also the American-British attacks that have not achieved their desired goal so far. The occupation army does not have the ability to fight a regional war, and this is what the Israelis must know well. These are the words by Ishtak Brick, former Israeli reserve. Professor Fatih Kolib, what about the Israelis' threat for destroying the Hodeida port?
I believe that if the occupation from day one had been able to fight against the fronts that opened in support and assistance to the Palestinian nation in the Gaza Strip, they would have launched an aggression against Lebanon and attacked Lebanon. But of course, there are certainly many issues that stand as a deterrence to the occupation. Most importantly, the Americans, who have taken some measures from the beginning under the pretext of not expanding the conflict, this strategy has completely failed. When we see a real war in southern Lebanon, a real war in the Red Sea, and a real war in Iraq, this means that for the Israelis,
this means that they're hurt. This means they've sensed a serious threat from the Yemeni front and its support for Gaza.
Certainly, in Yemen and in the Red Sea, there is no battle. There is a real war. And it is not a coincidence that the United States recruits its battleships and fleets with Britain and Egypt, or bombs Yemen. And it is not easy, because if Yemen has not caused the occupation pain, why are their supply lines open through the Arab countries then? If it has not caused the Americans pain, why are they attacking Yemen?
Therefore, what about Ishtak Brick's words about the inability of the occupation army to fight a regional war at this time?
If the occupation is truly capable, it should first end the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip, then think about other fronts. But it is unable to do that. If the Gaza Strip has held out and resisted during the period of 4 months, then it is better for Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen to resist and hold off for 4 years.
Analyst on Israeli affairs, Mr. Fatih Kolib, thank you very much for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your good follow-up. Until we meet again, take care.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
If Elon Musk was serious about free speech, as he claims, if he was serious about the right to information, he would never allow the banning of pro-Palestinian journalists and never entertain the thought of a past legislator and policy expert of an internationally condemned entity to head his content management. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, in late November last year, ex and Tesla owner Elon Musk traveled to occupied Palestinian territories after facing blistering criticism of anti-Semitism from the Zionist lobby group Anti-Defamation League. Musk, one of the world's richest men and notoriously self-absorbed, was speculated to have embarked on the trip to save his image and business after shareholder value on X plummeted to the tune of nearly $75 million following the Zionist lobby's smear campaign against him. Musk was escorted to various locations in the occupied territories where Hamas resistance fighters bravely engaged the Israeli occupation forces during the events of October 7th operation. There, Musk was subject to photo ops by Israeli media, seen standing next to staged atrocities, and fed the same disinformation that Zionist officials have in the past 4 months been brazenly peddling. Interestingly enough, Musk, surrounded by Zionist forces, refused to enter Gaza to hear the Palestinian side of the story, cowardly admitting that the besieged territory was too dangerous. The visit served as an opportunity for the Zionist regime to use one of the world's filthy rich men and influencers as a propaganda tool. What followed the visit was millions of social media users wondering, what exactly did the Israeli lobbies say, do, or promise to the American multi-billionaire? It was already known that there was some level of collaboration between Musk's iteration of X and Zionist technology, as well as a vicious paid disinformation campaign on X run by Israeli officials. Upon Musk's return to the US, something was different. X users who previously slanted towards the Palestinian cause saw suppression of their voices and began to lose followers. Then came the heavy-handed crackdown. Pro-Palestinian journalists were suspended without warning, particularly those who were adamantly taking part in Zionist billionaire Bill Ackman and his richest attacks on Palestinian student groups. They were eventually reinstated after widespread public backlash. Musk, who, in his earlier avatar, claimed to be a free speech absolutist has yet to comment on why these accounts were removed from his social media platform in the first place. Interestingly, the free speech absolutist, even prior to his trip to occupied Palestine, asserted that using or endorsing the world-famous slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," would result in a ban from the platform for advocating genocide. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu used this exact phrase only in outlining the full occupation of Palestine, which is resulting in an actual genocide and still exists on the platform. There is little doubt that Musk has submitted himself entirely to the Zionist lobby. Even before his ADL bout in November, Musk, whose father's wealth came from racist exploitations in apartheid South Africa, often sided with reactionary causes while protecting himself through humor and distractions. However, it must be soberly examined whether Musk was ever in any real control of X in the first place. Facts have surfaced that show Zionist infiltration of X even before the infamous Musk visit to occupy Palestine. Several high-ranking Israeli regime military personnel have been identified working for X and not in any small role. It has been revealed they specially work in positions of key influence at a popular social media company, specializing in content moderation and account suspensions. Take, for example, Michael Tachani, whose professional profile is readily available. Tachani works at the ex-Dublin office in a senior trust and safety position. Her resume is full of red flags. Not only was she an Israeli intelligence commander, but also worked for Netanyahu's National Security Council in 2015. Interestingly, she also worked for social media giant TikTok in a similar role, product policy manager. TikTok has also been notorious for banning pro-Palestinian voices, despite widespread and uncontested popularity of the Palestinian cause on the platform. Should a former assistant to head of legislation at an Israeli ministry be trusted to control and comment on biased moderation? How can one even retain a position knowing full well of their decades-long work at defending an apartheid regime, both through legislation and armed forces? There are others too. A hashtag on X seeks to expose various Israeli personnel, not just soldiers, but policy experts, influencers, and more in positions of unique influence using the hashtag IDFATX. Under this hashtag, you will find content moderators and policy specialists who can regulate who can say what. Their backgrounds include services in intelligence for Western militaries and agencies, as well as lobbying and think tanks. Most of the employees mentioned predate Musk's takeover at X Musk, who insisted he would free X and make it a playground for free speech, has brought in these moderators with sketchy backgrounds. Despite a mass firing and rounds of layoffs at the start of Musk's takeover, it seems that some of those who survived are uniquely in a position to defend the Israeli occupation. And these are just surface-level employees who happen to have some social clout themselves. Many would argue, so what? Saying past service in policymaking has no impact on grounds to create policy for a supposedly non-aligned tech company. By contrast, there are no employees, absolutely none. that are in any key position promoting the Palestinian cause or